Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. And if you own a dog and have a dog, I think there could be some cause for concern because we have canine influenza in the state and in other states, and it's spreading. So I think it's a cause for concern, and that's why we've asked Dr. Sandy Sawchuk to be with us from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She comes by actually every month to spend time with you and with me and give us some advice on keeping our pets healthy and happy. Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
Oh, it's so nice to be here.
Well, I tell you what, the topic isn't so much fun to talk about right now because there is an outbreak of canine influenza.
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
It's very similar to our influenza that we get. And so when dogs are sick with it, they are going to have symptoms like we do, runny nose, fever, coughing, you know, and it can progress to more serious things. Not in very many dogs, but, you know, some dogs can develop pneumonia, and there have been reported deaths as well. But I think what I need to do is just kind of go back and give you a little bit of history on influenza.
That'd be great.
Initially, the influenza was identified in about 2004, canine influenza. I'll call it CIV because it's a little easier because I'm probably going to be talking about it a lot over the next hour and a half. But it was initially diagnosed in racing greyhounds, and they picked it up, they think, from horses where a horse influenza virus jumped species and infected dogs.
Oh.
And so we've had this around for a number of years. It's been kind of patchy here and there, never been diagnosed in Wisconsin at this point yet. And that particular virus was called H3N8. And in 2009, a vaccine came out that reduces the incidence and the severity of the disease. But because we're just not seeing it in this area, very few veterinarians were using it. Well, a couple of weeks ago, there was an outbreak in the northern Illinois area, and it's now spread to many of the states in the Midwest, including Wisconsin, of dogs with symptoms of canine influenza virus, CIV. And so we made the assumption that it was this H3N8. But with further testing at our Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab in conjunction with Cornell University's lab as well, we found out that it was a brand new virus to this country, H3N2.
Okay? Oh, boy.
So it's a new influenza with identical symptoms, maybe a little more severe, but, you know, the same runny nose, coughing, fever. And the downside with this particular strain of influenza is that it can infect cats. And so it's not just a dog virus anymore. We do see cats being affected with this particular one. The H3N8 has never been shown to affect any other species, and so we weren't worried about cats. And there's been no evidence that either of these viruses can infect people as well. So, you know, at this point, we're saying, you know, for humans not to worry. But, you know, our big concern is this is a new virus, and we have this vaccine that's available for H3N8, but we really don't know if it's going to be protective. It may help, but it's probably not going to be as effective as the vaccine is against the original virus that we've had in our area. So our recommendations at the School of Veterinary Medicine, we had a big powwow session yesterday, and our recommendations are that, you know, the vaccine, H3N8 hasn't gone away. And even when we're doing all this testing and surveillance now, there cases of H3N8 are showing up as well as this new vaccine or new virus, that we still vaccinate because it's not going to hurt them. And it may help. It requires two doses a couple of weeks apart. And then about a week after that second one, the dog will have hopefully some protection. In the meantime, I think it's a really good idea for people to start looking at their dog's lifestyle and maybe making some adjustments because, we just don't know. We've had, so far in Wisconsin, one identified case. It came was a dog that had been in the Chicago area, had come to the vet school, immediately got put in our isolation unit. And thank goodness we have that, because it's got separate air ventilation and so on, because nobody has protection against, none of our canine patients or feline patients have protection against this particular bug. And so this was, you know, we had that case in. That dog has since gone home. Their other dog, and now I just heard today their two cats are ill as well. So and the sister's dog who was hanging with those. So, you know, because dogs can shed it for you know, before they start showing signs, even an apparently healthy dog could potentially infect your dog. So we're recommending trying to, you know, cut down on nose-to-nose contact and dogs being in close confined areas. Like, you know, maybe don't go to the dog park. Or if you do, have your dog on a leash so you can keep them away from other dogs. And, you know, just using common sense that way. And we'll talk more about it as the show goes on.
Yeah, I'm sure of that. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Roberta in Lake Geneva has a question for you. Hi, Roberta. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. How are you today?
Great. Appreciate your call. What's on your mind?
Well, I have to pick up a brand new born puppy. She'll be 7.5 weeks old in about 2 weeks. And all of a sudden, this whole thing just scared the bejabbers of me as I'm driving around.
Yeah.
I lost a dog to lepto last September. October.
Oh, I'm so
sorry. In fact, I believe I may have talked to you at the university in a last-ditch effort of me trying to save her life. She had gone into extreme kidney failure.
Mm-hmm.
And this new little girl, whose name is Baby Abigail,
okay,
is the replacement friend for my 9-year-old golden labradoodle. Anyway, so what do I do to protect Baby Abigail when she comes in my house?
That's a really good question. And you know what? It is not just the influenza that you have to be afraid of. It's all these diseases that dogs can potentially get. And a couple of things that I would be recommending. Number one is that you set up an appointment immediately with your veterinarian to get your dog, if the breeder hasn't already started, on vaccinations.
I think she has.
That's good.
Good. You know, so we give puppies a series of vaccinations, primarily because we don't know when their body is going to be able to mount an immune response, because they do get passive immunity through the milk from their mother that disappears at various rates, depending on the dog, depending on the disease that you're talking about. So, you know, I think that, you know, keeping your dog on a vaccination schedule that would be appropriate for puppies. We at the veterinary school follow the American Animal Hospital Association's canine vaccine guidelines. And even though it's a big document, there's still a lot of good information in there that you may want to go online and review that, just so you can kind of see what's recommended. So typically, we'll give the distemper, adenovirus 2, and parvo vaccine about every 3 to 4 weeks until the dog gets to be about 16 weeks of age. We usually start the leptospirosis vaccine when they're about 12 weeks of age, and then give that twice when they're like about 3 to 4 weeks apart. Sometimes if it's a tiny dog, we'll delay it so that we're not giving a whole boatload of vaccines at one time. Rabies vaccines typically given when they're 12 to 16 weeks of age. Obviously, the kennel cough vaccine would be something that you can give at any point, and that would be for Bordetella and parainfluenza. It's usually some drops in the nose, or there is an oral vaccine as well. But this new canine influenza bug, I would be recommending that your puppy be vaccinated for that as well. And that's labeled for dogs 6 weeks of age and up. And so this would be, again,
no problem
at all with getting started on that. But, you know, this really poses a dilemma for people, because you want to get your dog out and socialize and around other dogs and around other people. But, you know, before canine influenza hit the scene, I would be telling people, you know, to get them enrolled in a dog training class, you know, making sure that everybody is healthy. And I think that that's really important, because, you know, the number one killer of dogs are not these diseases. It is The fact that they are poorly socialized and maybe not being trained appropriately, and people get rid of them. That's the behavior problems are the number one reason for dogs to be surrendered before a year of age. So you have to weigh out the pros and cons. As long as the all the puppies in the training group are in the same boat, that they've all been vet checked, they've all been vaccinated, they are healthy at that time. You're taking a small chance, but I think it's minimal compared to what it would be if you didn't get your dog there. Now, I would not take your dog to the dog park. I would not go to the pet store with it because no one's checking vaccination certificates at that point. So those would be places I would avoid.
And you really need to have that, just as an aside to, on the behavior thing, you've said before that puppies need to get socialized very quickly. Or there's problems.
There definitely can be problems. And it's it's not that there's like a certain time that boom, if we don't get it done by now, it's going to be a problem. But we like to see puppies get started. And in fact, the position statement by the American Association of Veterinary Animal Behaviorists, AVSAB, okay, has a position statement regarding starting dogs in training class. And they're like 8 weeks of age, you need to get started. So yes, they've only had maybe one vaccination into them, but at least they've been veterinary checked and they should be healthy, not having anything contagious that they can pass dog to dog. I mean, it's a small chance. Yes, there may be diseases, but I think it's still very important to get your dog out there.
So there you go. Good luck, Roberta, and thank you so much for calling. I appreciate your call very much. I want to give Jackie in Milwaukee a chance to join us as well. Jackie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Morning. I bet you're scared with the cats being brought in. I will very quickly, I was going to say just exactly what the doctor was saying. I heard about this on a scanner where ham operators were talking, and the one woman was warning her brother not even to let his dog go to the dog next door because they don't show symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm correct on that.
And, I kind of look at it the same way as us. When people come to me and they're in panic mode, which is what's happening, people are just like, oh my goodness, I want to just put my dog in a bubble. I turn it around and start asking them questions about what they do during human influenza season. Now, the dog influenza is not a seasonal bug. It can occur year-round. But the human influenza tends to be more in the winter months and so on. Do you as a human being avoid going to the grocery store or not shake people's hands or not visit with family members because you're terrified that they're going to give you the flu? Or, and how many people avoid or don't want to get vaccinated for it and yet still are out there, leading a normal life? It's one of those things that you have to kind of weigh out the pros and cons. And I think that, when we have really young animals, very old animals, or animals with what we call comorbidities, which means having other diseases, like maybe they've got some type of a respiratory problem or heart disease or cancer, or even in the case of my dogs, their confirmation, because I have English bulldogs, would make it very difficult for them to deal with nasal discharge and coughing. We need to be a little more concerned about those, but I just don't want people to be like, oh my goodness, I have to, have my dog be in a bubble. Just be smart about it. Mm-hmm. And, if you're out in wide open spaces, it's not going to be an issue, but it's more confined spaces. Remember, the virus can survive on clothing and hands. So, human contact, I make sure that I'm between every patient, I'm washing my hands thoroughly. We're disinfecting rooms. And we're just being really careful that way. But don't lose sleep over it, but just be smart about it.
All right. Thanks, Jackie. Appreciate the call very much. We have Jerry in Chilton up next. Hi, Jerry. Thank you for calling. Let's get you on here. Hi, Jer.
Hi. How are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I don't know if I got a partial answer. I've been listening in. But this new strain of flu that apparently can affect cats as well, you say that there have been a few cases in the clinic, and they have since gone home. So apparently they must have developed some form of antigens, as they taken any blood serum or plasma from these animals?
Yeah, that's a...
Possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, it does take a while to make a vaccine. And so, like, when the initial canine influenza came out in 2004, the first commercially available vaccine for it didn't come out until 2009. So, you know, it doesn't, it's not a simple thing to just say, you know, here we're going to, you know, take some blood from a dog and have it, you know, be, you know, give it to other dogs and have it be protective. So, you know, and the fact that that dog went home didn't mean that it got better. What we are recommending to veterinarians is that if you have a suspect case in, have the owners leave their dog in the car. What we're going to be doing at the veterinary school, rain or shine, is do our initial triage exam in the parking lot. So we're going to be taking out, you know, not hazmat suits, but, you know, gowns, gloves, mm-hmm. and a biohazard bag, and do our exam, listen to the lung fields, take the temperature, you know, get our history out in the parking lot, and send those dogs home if they're still feeling okay, and just let them get over it at home, you know, just like you would. You would go home and, you know, drink chicken soup and rest and so on. If they have to be hospitalized, they are going to be put in a transport cage, totally, so they're not touching the ground, covered up, and immediately shuttled through the hospital into our isolation unit that has double doors, separate air ventilation, and it's going to be, you know, we'll just keep them in that area. So we're working on, you know, trying to, you know, handle cases that way. And it's a matter of owners, you know, being respectful of, if you have a sick dog, realize that it may have to stay home and yeah. not be actually in the hospital.
Jerry, thanks much.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Talking today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, we're learning how to keep your pets happy and healthy from Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Join in at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on our Facebook page a question and a pet photo. Love to see that as well. That's at The Larry Mueller Show. That's the title of our Facebook page. We had caller Frank wondering, and this goes back to our flu that we've been discussing, hand sanitizers. He has a question about, if will the hand sanitizers kill the germs so you don't risk passing it on from pet to pet?
Yes, but we are still recommending using soap and water. I like to tell people that all you have to do is show the influenza virus a bar of soap and it rolls over and dies. You know, it's killed very easily with soap and water. Kind of standard disinfectants that you use in clinics will work. You know, hand sanitizer isn't quite as good. So soap and water is going to be the best. But in a pinch, you can use hand sanitizer. But this is the issue with dogs, is they don't use hand sanitizer, and they put their noses in places where, you know, we may not as people. And so, you know, it's easy for humans to, you know, keep their hands clean, like, you know, grocery carts and so on when you're shopping. But for dogs, they, you know, that's why they can pass the disease from dog to dog fairly easily. But I think if you have been around a dog that's been sick, and this is for veterinarians and just the general people, you know, just practice good hygiene. Wash your hands.
And Judith's telling me that she's been getting quite a few follow-up questions about cats. People are wondering, is my cat or are our cats at risk?
They are. But, you know, so far we're seeing them in households that have dogs that are infected. The new strain actually originated in China and Korea, in that area, and has been somehow brought into our country. And they were seeing cats affected over there. So it's not surprising that we're seeing it happen over here. That's a really good question, whether we're going to see cat-to-cat transmission, or is it just, you know, dog-to-cat because they're in close confines in a household. That I can't tell you.
We had, just another topic entirely, Janine just said that her friend had two female cats spayed And both of them, their personalities changed a lot. Is that common?
It shouldn't be, because when you're spaying them and remove it, which involves removing the ovaries and the uterus, remember cats cycle when they're in heat. You may have them being, less, when a cat's in heat, they tend to be very vocal and they roll around and so on. But when they're not in heat, that's what their personality's like. My guess is that it was probably an age-related personality change. We typically spay and neuter cats when they're kittens or, just early, like 6-7 months of age. And as cats mature, you are going to see them mellowing out a little bit and being maybe less playful than they were when they were young. We'll also see cats that are spayed and neutered put weight on. And it's not because the spaying and neutering is making them gain weight. It's because we're overfeeding them. And so the neutering does change their metabolism so that they don't need to take in as much food. But sometimes overweight cats are going to have a personality change just because they can't get up and move and they're maybe a little uncomfortable and they get winded easily. So you may be seeing that as well. So I'd have to know a little bit more about what they meant by personality change, but I think it's probably all just normal.
Michelle in DeForest, thanks for calling. Hi.
I had a question about my dog.
Okay.
He's 2 years old. We adopted him from a puppy rescue, and since we've gotten him, we've had problems with either sensitive skin, very sensitive skin, or issues with very loose stools and bloody mucus in the stools. So we've had him on about 9 different types of dog food. That's all I can remember for now, but I'm pretty sure we've had him on even more. And so my neighbor suggested calling in. She thought she remembered hearing a WPR where you guys talked about some kind of something where you'd give it to the dog in addition to his food if he's stressed out, and it might possibly help.
Well, food allergies are not as common as environmental allergies. And so it could be either one. But when we do see dogs with food allergies, really the only way to be able to diagnose, does my dog have a food allergy, is to feed them a very strict hypoallergenic diet. And by that, I mean they don't get heartworm preventative that's in a chewable form. They don't get treats. They get a hydrolyzed protein diet that is not recognized by the dog's body as to where the protein came from. So many of them are made with chicken, but because that protein's broken down into little bits, you're not going to get the same reaction. And it can take a good 8 weeks plus to be able to determine whether your dog's itchiness and gastrointestinal symptoms are a result of having food allergies. So I don't know when you've been switching diets what you've actually been using. But remember, the over-the-counter diets that claim to be a limited antigen diet, some of them will say like duck and potato or rabbit and green pea, those are manufactured in plants that also handle other foods. And so they are not truly a hypoallergenic diet. You do have to use diets that are therapeutic diets that you can get by prescription from your veterinarian.
Right. And that was our next step. We've been kind of, doing what we can on our own, but the next step was the $90 biggest dog.
To actually rule out this disease, I think that is really important to do that. Is it going to cost you $90? Why not at the vet school? Even the biggest bag is not going to be that expensive, but there are online food delivery systems that you may want to ask for an outside prescription and do some pricing around if this is something that your dog has to be on forever. Once you've got a diagnosis, you may want to consider doing some dietary trials, like maybe have a beef week or a tofu week or a chicken week to see what is it that my dog's actually reacting to. Most people just choose to keep them on the diet and just really have them on a regimen lifestyle and, be really careful about what goes in.
And so you don't, off the top of your head, know what that was, the supplement. She was thinking it was like triage dog
I don't know what that would be. May have been Dr. Donahue or somebody else that was on. But to my knowledge, there are no supplements that you can give that would help with food allergies.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I was trying to remember if... I just don't recall that. Karen in Oconomowoc, it's your turn. Hi, Karen.
Hello. Hello.
Hi. Hello. What's on your mind?
About the CIV, I know you said that your dog is contagious before they show symptoms, but after they have symptoms, how long do they shed the virus? How long should you keep your dog away from other animals so that you don't contribute to this being dispersed throughout the dog population?
Yeah, well, we're assuming that the H3N2, this new one, is behaving like other influenza bugs. We really don't know yet, but the most influenza bugs are going to end up, the dog will incubate it for 2 or 3 days before, and during that time they may be shedding it, but be asymptomatic. And then symptoms usually last for about 5 to 7 days, and they can shed it for 10 to 14 days after they first start showing symptoms. So what we're telling people, if your dog is symptomatic, keep them isolated and away from other dogs for a minimum of 2 weeks.
2 weeks. Okay. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Caller Bob from Wauwatosa wondered if there's a good place online for us to check regularly for updates on the canine influenza issue.
Yes, the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, we have updates there. The Wisconsin Veterinary Diagnostic Lab also has influenza information on there that's very current. The press release and all the new information was just actually released, I believe, late last night. And Cornell University also has current information, because between Wisconsin and Cornell, we're in the forefront of trying to get a better handle on this.
Jim in Wisconsin Rapids up next. Hi, Jim. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. I have an 11-year-old female Malamute that has lost the majority of her fur on her tail.
Well, one of the things that I worry about is, does she have other symptoms? Like, is she gaining weight? Does she have any hair loss anywhere else that may be not quite as in your face as her totally denuded tail? But I worry about things like hypothyroidism, a low thyroid hormone. The tail, because it wears more, we'll often see these dogs have like this rat tail with their very sparse hair over it. So that would be one thing that I would be looking into. There are other skin diseases that the northern breeds can get, like zinc-responsive skin issues, but typically that's going to be affecting the face and other areas of the body, not just the tail. But a visit to your veterinarian, and it's really easy to diagnose a thyroid disorder. It's just a matter of sending a blood sample to an appropriate lab, and it's easily treated as well, twice-a-day medication.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jim, for calling. Appreciate your call. We have more callers online. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Here's a Facebook question from Karen. Are feces from other dogs that have not been picked up a risk for transmitting the virus, going back to the virus?
No, it's all respiratory. And so fecal transmission is not a problem. What I get worried about with stool are there are some other viruses like parvovirus, distemper virus, intestinal parasites. Those would be all things that we would be concerned about, but not the CIV virus.
Facebook question from Linda as well. I was told by a vet clinic that I can use both Frontline Plus and the Seresto collar at the same time for flea and tick prevention. A second source says definitely not. Could you give your opinion? This would be specifically for a 24-pound Cocker Spaniel with no other health issues.
They would be compatible. They're all different medications. The Seresto collar has a couple of different chemicals in there. I find that just the Seresto collar itself is a very effective tool for keeping fleas and ticks off of dogs and cats. It's safe for cats as well. And it lasts for 8 months. Really good safety profile. So, I'm wondering why you're wanting to double up. And unless you're in like an extremely heavy tick area. And if so, you know, you may want to be looking at maybe even considering one of the new oral products that are out there, Bravecto or NexGard. But we rarely get to that situation where we have to double up. But the few times where we've done it, it is safe to use the two together.
All right. We have callers online here again at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Katie in Milwaukee next. Hi, Katie. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thank you for taking the call. I appreciate it.
Sure.
I have about an 8-year-old American Bulldog who's had a hacking cough most of the winter, and we did go to the vet. We just finished 2 weeks of two types of pills, and I'm sorry, I don't know which one they are, but she's not gotten any better, and she's actually more phlegmy in her hacking. I'm wondering if this really is more the influenza you're talking about than a kennel cough.
No, because that doesn't last that long. If she's been like this all winter, remember, a cough is a symptom of many, many diseases. Everything from, primary respiratory pathogens to cancer, lung cancer, to heart disease, heartworm, parasites that live in the cardiovascular system. So lots and lots of different things. If you're worried about kennel cough, and I really would be not thinking kennel cough would not be on the top of my list for something like this. You may want to talk to your veterinarian about doing one of the veterinary diagnostic lab has a respiratory pathogen panel, involves taking a nasal swab and submitting it, and it looks for all the most of the infectious causes of canine cough, because kennel cough is just one of those terms that we use because dogs that pick up infectious diseases often are in situations like kennels. But there's many, many causes, from a dog distemper to respiratory coronavirus to the new influenza bug, mycoplasma, all kinds of things like that. And although it's not an inexpensive test, it ends up running about $110 or so, it does get that off the table and rule out all those diseases. But if your dog has not been in and had chest x-rays taken, had a good physical exam, I would strongly recommend getting that taken care of sooner rather than later.
Okay, that makes sense. I mean, he listened to her heart, and so there was something. Her lungs sounded, her heart sounded good, and then prescribed this 2-week course of medication. So, sounds like more investigation needs to be done.
Chest X-rays really need to be done. And this is one of the dilemmas that we're coming up with, too, is everybody's just jumping on the bandwagon, assuming my dog is coughing, thus it has to be influenza. Remember, there are lots of other common reasons for coughing out there. And so talk to your veterinarian and let them decide, is this something that we can get the dog into the hospital and should we be doing it? And I think with your dog, definitely needs to go into the hospital and have some workup done.
All right.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Katie. Beth in Green Bay, hi to you.
Hi. Yes, I own a grooming shop, and I was just wondering, is there any symptoms I can look out for if someone comes in with a dog that has influenza?
Yeah, they typically have a runny nose, and that it can start out clear, and then because the virus causes so much damage to the lining of the respiratory system, you get secondary bacterial infections, and so then that discharge may turn yellowish or green. And remember, there's other causes for yellow-green nasal discharge, like the dog may have inhaled a piece of grass or something like that too, or have another type of infection in there. Coughing, running a fever, being really depressed and lethargic. Think about the last time you may have had the flu, and then put that into the dog's body, and that's how they feel.
Okay, and will my normal disinfecting routine take care of the virus if one does get in here and I don't realize until it's too late? Variety of disinfectants.
Yeah, most of the disinfectants that are available are readily killed. And again, this would be something that you can go to the website and even look up things for information for veterinarians, because on our website we have stuff on how to get rid of it once it's already in the clinic.
Great. Okay.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. And the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine, Well, if you type that in, that's going to come up. We have a link to it. Judith's put a link up on our Facebook page. You can certainly go right to it from our Facebook page as well. And Julie in Milwaukee, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I am considering adopting a Schipperke that has sebaceous adenitis.
Adenitis? Uh-huh.
And I already have one Schipperke.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, you know, just...
Yeah,
this is a good idea.
This is a genetic problem. I primarily see it in poodles, but it obviously can affect other breeds of dogs. And it's more of an issue with just needing frequent bathing. Their coat is not going to look as good. They may get secondary infections and things that may need to be treated. But it is not contagious from dog to dog. It is a genetic problem. So obviously this would be a dog that you would not want to be using for breeding. But it's just, if you know, don't mind the extra work of the coat care, these guys can live a completely normal life, but sometimes they just don't look very pretty. So,
and how often is the bathing?
It really depends on the severity of the disease in the dog. It may be just weekly bathing to get rid of some of the flaking and things. Sometimes it has to be more often, but it's not unmanageable. But your dog, you know, probably will be having bad hair days more than good hair days.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, Julie. Thanks very much for calling. And Darlene in Mount Horeb, your turn. Hi, Darlene.
Okay. Thank you. Dr. Sachak, we have a 12-year-old cat with brown spots on the iris of one of his eyes, and he had these several years ago. It started out as just a couple small spots that he had for years, and then all of a sudden, within a short period of time, they seemed to multiply, and our normal vet was kind of concerned about it. She thought it could be melanoma or turn into that, so she suggested we go to an ophthalmologist. So we went there, and she looked at them and kind of told us about it, that, indeed, it could turn into melanoma, but the only way you're really going to know is if you remove the eye and do a biopsy. And she said, well, at this point, let's just follow it, just keep an eye. So 8 months later, we went back and had her look again, and we didn't seem to think that it had changed very much, so she kind of said again, let's just keep an eye on it. But I just wanted to know what you have to say about this. And our normal vet said, because it's only on one eye, it's probably not age-related.
Yeah. We see kind of two conditions occurring in cats' eyes. One is called iris melanosis, which is just kind of, you know, you get some pigment change to the iris, and it is not a tumor. It's just kind of happens with cats. You'll get these little spots that'll be there. Sometimes people will call them iris freckles. And when I get a patient in like this, I usually take a photograph and make sure that it's in the record so that I have some way of being able to track it year to year. The iris melanoma, whenever humans hear the word melanoma, we think, oh my God, death sentence. Because when we get a melanoma on our skin, it can be a very highly malignant tumor. Iris melanomas in cats tend to really slowly metastasize. It can be years before it happens. And so you're doing exactly what I would be recommending, just monitoring, making sure that the intraocular pressures are normal, that eye itself is, you know, looking at the retina and so on. Everything else is looking okay. And if, you know, the cat's doing fine, we can leave the eye in there. But if it looks like it is spreading and, you know, we're getting some changes, maybe pigment cells shedding off of the iris and into the anterior chamber of the eye, or the pressures are going up because maybe you've got secondary glaucoma, then by all means, we have to remove the eye. And I mean, obviously, that's kind of the last thing you want to do, because your cat really needs its vision if it can. So I think watching it and seeing and following following what the ophthalmologist is saying, but I'm glad you're hooked up with an ophthalmologist, because when I get these cases in, even though I can look at them, I am very grateful that I have a big ophthalmology service right around the corner from me, and they are glad to take these cases on and help with the monitoring as well.
Yeah, there we go.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Darlene. Appreciate the call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio as we take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. And again, thank you so much for joining us. Questions? Call us at 800-642-1234. If you got a photo and a question, or just a photo, go to our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And, oh boy, Tori sent a wonderful shot of a black.
Isn't that a beautiful? That is such a beautiful dog. It's a black German Shepherd named Tori.
Really, really pretty dog. And another one from Daniel, I should say. Photo, clean beds, clean dog, new collar, my cucumber and melon scented doggy sandwich. Oh, that is so, so cute. What a great photo. Anyway, there's a couple up there. You could send your own. Love to see it. Liz in Wrightstown up next with a question. Hi, Liz.
Hi. I have a question about my cat. I have a cat who's about, he's 16 years old, and we just got him probably about 2-3 years ago. Mm-hmm. And just lately, he, on his front, well, where I first noticed it, it was on his front left paw and on the inside, and it looked like his hair is gone. It's mm-hmm. not straight down to the skin, but most of his hair is gone. And then now I'm kind of noticing it on his back legs, kind of on his inner thigh mm-hmm. part of his area. And I have another cat and a dog, and neither one of them has any kind of, you know, isn't showing any of the same symptoms or anything like that. And I guess I was just kind of wondering what you think it might be. I thought maybe he would be kind of chewing on the skin, and that's what would cause it. But.
Yeah, a lot of cats will barber their coat. There's a wonderful Klein Education handout by a group called Veterinary Partners. If you just Google fur mowing, like mowing your lawn, that will be one of the first things that come up in with the search. And, you know, I suggest that you have a look at that. This can be a real mystery to try to get this under control. We used to think that a lot of cats that did this kind of over-grooming and, you know, where they're just, the hair is being removed, were having some mental health issues, and this was kind of a way of them barbering their coat, kind of like a person biting their fingernails chewing on their own hair, something like that. The way we tell whether the hair is falling out or whether the cat is actually barbering it is we pluck some of the shorter hairs in that spot and have a look under the microscope, and you can see the ends are all roughened rather than being the normal shaped hair, which would just be, you know, shorter hair growing in. So that's one thing that your veterinarian may do. We start thinking medically about cats, even though he's 16 years of age, it's kind of odd to be developing allergies at this point in his life. But allergic problems can be part of this. Anything from flea allergy, dermatitis, and even indoor cats, if you even just get a flea or two into your house, if they are sensitized to them, they can develop a flea allergy, dermatitis. And so we always start these cats that are doing this barbering on good year-round flea control. We sometimes see this with food allergies as well. We can see this with environmental allergies to house dust mites and pollens. We can see it with other parasites, like there's one that's called Demodex that is a specific cat Demodex organism that can cause them to itch, and you can get patchy areas of hair loss as well. And so it's doing skin scraping, sometimes cultures, food trials, you know, allergy testing, all these things are things that you can be looking at and doing it on a stepwise fashion. Normally what I do in these cases is get them on flea control, try them on a hypoallergenic diet, and then take it to the next level to see if, you know, if they don't get better, jump to the next level, which can be allergy testing and doing all kinds of other things as well. So, yeah, have a look at that article. I think you'll find that very, very helpful.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And let's turn to Jay in Two Rivers next. Hi, Jay. Thanks for calling.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
I've got a nine-month-old female Border Collie Aussie mix and recently applied a Seresto collar. We live next to Point Beach State Forest, which has a lot of deer, deer ticks, et cetera, and Lake Michigan. The dog loves to swim. In fact, most of our dogs have spent 45 minutes at a time out in the lake in the summer with us swimming when it's warm enough. Will that collar be effective until the end of deer and tick season?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, and remember, our tick season here is, I like to tell people that they don't need 365 days of tick control, but they do need 12 months of tick control if you live in Wisconsin. Huh. Because remember, ticks don't hibernate. They just kind of sit there and wait for the air temperature to warm up. And deer ticks love that 30 to 40 degree temperature. So we can get warming spells even in January that may require a dog to have some type of a tick control on them. The Seresto collar, although it's labeled to last for 8 months, that is for a dog that is maybe just being bathed once in a while, but not in the water a lot. Frequent swimming is going to lessen the efficacy of the collar to about 5 months. One of the things that you may want to be looking into, since you've already invested in the collar, I would keep that on your dog, but just say, okay, from the day I put it on with swimming, maybe 5 months it's going to last. You may want to look into one of the new oral products that are out there. They got launched last year. One is by the Mariel Company, and it's called NexGard, and it's given once a month, and it's for fleas and ticks. The other is called Brevecto. It's by the Merck Company, and it lasts for 3 months, and so you just use it four times a year to keep ticks under control. They all are extremely safe and very, very effective. And so between the Seresto collar and the oral products, those are probably my favorite things to be using for flea and tick control.
There we go.
Well, thank you. And do young dogs eventually acclimate to the things that they consume outside, like little berries, quagga mussels, and just the different water that they drink out of
Yeah.
Well, they're probably not going to adjust to it, but I get, you know, worried. Hopefully your dog has been vaccinated for leptospirosis. Remember, that is a disease that can be spread through urine of infected animals, and it likes to live in water, and so your dog would be more at risk than some other dogs that may just be walking on a sidewalk and not having any contact with infected water. Be really careful about what your dog is ingesting outside. There's, you know, not all berries are going to be safe, and you know, even things like some of the flowers and things like that we put in our yards, like hyacinths and tulips and, you know, crocuses and things like that, can be really irritating to the oral cavity if they ingest them. So, you know, having a young dog that likes to put everything in their mouth just means that you have to be a more watchful owner and keep redirecting your dog to more appropriate things, like, you know, playing with the ball or something that's going to be safer to have in their mouth than some foreign material that they find when they're at the park.
Right. It's taken quite an effort to do that. We've already gone through one prescription of metoclopramide. And let's see.
Some others as well.
Right, yeah. And that can happen if they're ingesting a lot of foreign material and things. And, you know, be also aware of Giardia. If, you know, Giardia is a parasite that lives in the gut, and we can get it Our Giardia, although it's the same species that dogs get, we don't usually see cross-species contamination. But if another dog is defecated in an area where there's water, then it can be contaminated with Giardia, and that may be what's, you know, giving your dog the frequent GI upset as well. And that would be, you know, another simple test to be able to do. And unfortunately, metronidazole is not that effective for Giardia in dogs. Yeah. We like to use other drugs.
There we go, Jay. Thanks for calling. Stella in Sturgeon Bay, your turn. Hi, Stella.
Hi. excuse me. We adopted two kittens, brother and sister, littermates. They are now 7 months old. We adopted them when they were about 3 months old.
Okay.
And our vet, when we were going through the inoculations series, our vet told us that about a pound a month gain is normal.
Mm-hmm.
Weight gain. And one of our kittens, Henry, lives to eat, and Jasmine, his sister, eats to live.
Okay.
And we're feeding them about half of a tableware teaspoon of canned meat a day, which we mix pet probiotics into.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things when you have two cats is you really do have to start feeding them separately. I have two cats. One gets fed in the lower level of the house. One gets fed upstairs. And it's, you know, you've got cats with totally different needs. And we just don't want them as 7 month old kittens to gain a lot of extra weight. Larry, you know what that's like.
I've got the same problem.
Same problem. And it's a tough situation. Not impossible, but it does mean feeding your kittens more like we feed dogs, meal feeding, than, you know, having food out and letting them, you know, interact with each other's food dishes. You have to just feed them separately.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
I know. It's not easy, but it needs to be done.
All right. Thank you so much, Stella, for calling. Appreciate your call. And certainly you can join in, too. Would love to hear from you. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And go to our Facebook page, the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. You can post your questions and your comments there. And I see we have a few up on Facebook and a couple of emails as well. And we'll get to them. Take a look at the news, and then we'll be back with our guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Stay with us. No, it's always great to have a happy, healthy pet to keep you company. So when they're under the weather, you want to, of course, you want them to get better and give them the same quality care that you might want for yourself or your loved ones, your other loved ones. Larry Mueller here, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. Our guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine comes by once a month to talk with us. And Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
It is so nice to be here. You know, I just love getting all these questions because it makes me think. And then I go back and I quiz my students with some of this stuff and go, what answer would you give? You know, so.
Oh, yeah. That's a great tease. So always the educator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you need to educate Sarah a bit here from Madison, because she has a question, I think. Hi, Sarah.
Hello. Thanks so much for your great show. I had a piggyback question regarding the gentleman with his dogs and the Lyme's disease question. I have an eight-month-old giant schnauzer puppy, and we'll be taking it up north to a really heavily infested area where my dogs have gotten Lyme's. And in the past, and I know you mentioned, I think, Bravectro and Vectra as two possible systemics.
It's called NexGard is the one, and Bravecto is the other oral. And these are both by different companies. The NexGard lasts for a month, and Bravecto, which is labeled for, I believe, dogs 7 months of age and up, lasts for 3 months. They're very similar molecules. One's just a little bit different, so it has a little bit longer activity.
Okay, and how do you feel about the Lyme vaccine, its safety and efficacy, and would you use it in combination with these medications or one of these medications?
It really is one of those lifestyle-dependent vaccines. Remember, there are a lot of other tick-borne diseases out there, and What I get concerned about is people assuming that if I vaccinate my dog with the Lyme vaccine, that I don't have to practice good tick control because they're going to be protected. Well, you know, we see equal number of cases of anaplasma. We're starting to see in cases of dogs from our area with Ehrlichia. And there's even some tick-borne diseases that we probably haven't even identified at this point yet. So there, you know, I think the Lyme vaccine is a good backup if you're in a heavy, heavy tick area and you're still practicing good tick control. You may want to consider vaccinating. It is a 2 vaccination series, a couple of weeks apart, and appears to be very safe. We've had a few dogs that develop local reactions at the injection site that can be a little uncomfortable, but it appears to be a very safe vaccine. But you still practice your good tick control. Mm-hmm. But if it's just a quick visit when you're up there, I'd say, you know, if you're here and you're, I mean, we see dogs even in the Madison area contracting Lyme. Most dogs that end up getting exposed to Lyme never show clinical signs. It's a very different disease than it is in people. And I think people are terrified of it, but it's more from the human standpoint than it is from the dog standpoint. The majority of dogs remain asymptomatic for the rest of their life.
There we go. Thank you so much for calling, Sarah. Appreciate your call. I want to give Karen and Madison a chance to join us. Karen, hi.
Hello. I wanted to make a comment for the lady who had a cat who was losing hair on its appendages.
Mm-hmm.
I've always had cats, and I've had several respond to stress by over-grooming, and I didn't hear your entire answer, so I didn't know whether you mentioned that.
I did. Yes, I did.
I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Thank you for bringing it up. You know, and this is, it's amazing how, I mean, I've been a vet for almost, my 35th class reunion is coming up next month. Oh, okay. And how things have changed in that period of time when initially as a new graduate and, you know, in working in the, you know, the trenches, we would see these cats barbering and we'd say, oh, it's all behavioral, it's stress related, cut down on stress, you know, and so on. But as time has gone on, we have now found that accounts for very few number of cases. Most of them have some type of either infectious, parasitic, or allergic component as the cause for it. So it's, you know, things have shifted in the last few years. And so we typically like to look at, you know, rather than just jumping to the conclusion that this is a 16-year-old cat that's stressed, start looking for underlying reasons for it.
There we go.
So what was the parasite you mentioned again?
Demodex gattoi is the name of the parasite. Very different than dog Demodex. If you read about dog Demodex, it's not contagious dog to dog. But this one is highly contagious and very itchy.
There you go.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Karen. And a Facebook question from Diane wondering if you could address collapsing trachea. My dog has the beginning of it. It's surgery the way to completely treat it? Currently on Clavamox and Olanapril to reduce fluids around a minor right side heart enlargement.
Yeah.
The dog is 13.
I'm concerned that this dog, it may have some component of having a weak trachea. The trachea is made up of these cartilaginous rings that hold its shape so we can continue to get air in and out. But some dogs, especially some of the small breed dogs, poodles, chihuahuas, rat terriers, and so on, those cartilage rings can be weaker. And so when the dog is, you know, breathing hard, doing anything, that the trachea can kind of flatten out and they'll end up with kind of a goose honky type cough. I would not be expecting this to be developing in a 13-year-old dog. This is something the dog has pretty much most of its life. And so the fact that it's starting now and the dog has heart disease, remember that main airway runs right over the top of the heart. And so if the heart is bigger than normal, it could be causing some compression on that airway and that could be resulting in the cough. I'm not sure why your dog is on antibiotics. Clavamox is a broad spectrum antibiotic. That is, you know, we'd use that for infections, not for collapsing trachea. And and not for heart disease. So I'm, you know, I'm just questioning why that's, you know, why that's being done. The way you can determine whether your dog really has collapsing trachea is you can have them referred someplace that has the ability to do fluoroscopy, where the dog lays on the x-ray table and has a moving x-ray done, and we actually see if the trachea is snapping down or not. It's sometimes hard to diagnose just on a single x-ray. It's because that's just a moment in time, and it may not be collapsed at that point.
Mm. There we go. Lynn and Sturgeon, I'm sorry, Lynn and Sister Bay, hello to you.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Dr. Sandy.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
What's on your mind, Lynn?
Oh, what's on my mind is my sweet little 5.5-year-old cockapoo has, for the last 3 years, become increasingly anxious in the car. She's not one of those joyful dogs that leaps in the car and can hardly wait for a ride.
Mm-hmm,
she, two years ago, she stood up, did not sit down the entire way to Florida and back.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my
panting,
goodness.
Panting and...
just terrified.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, but she jumps right in the car when I'm ready to go.
Yeah, she doesn't want to leave you, but, you know, that's not uncommon for dogs to be that way. A few things that you may want to be looking at. Sometimes having them confined to a smaller environment, like a crate, that you can put a blanket over it or something, where they're not going to see the world whipping by, and they may feel a little more secure, may help. I would definitely be recommending that if you are going to be trying something like this, that you do dry runs at home before you start on a multi-day trip to the south, where she goes in the car. Maybe all you do is start the engine and she just sits in the car while you're in the driveway reading the paper. She's getting treats from you, and this isn't so bad. Then maybe you're just going to back out of the driveway and come right back in again, or go around the block and maybe just make some very short trips. It's very helpful to have somebody that can be there with you, that can be administering the food. It's hard to drive and desensitize your dog to car riding, so having somebody there to help, where they can be giving your dog little bits of food or something, assuming that your dog doesn't get car sick when they're in the car as well. If you don't have time to do that, I think the only fair thing to do would be to get this dog on some type of anti-anxiety medication prior to travel. And we use drugs in the benzodiazepine family, which would be things like Xanax and Valium in dogs. You can use sedatives as well, which don't take away anxiety, but will help her with maybe sleeping and laying down and being maybe a little more comfortable. The drug we typically use is called aceprolamine, and that also helps with some nausea and things that's associated with car riding. But I have a dog that I have to carry out of the house and put in the car. That's how bad he is with getting in the car. And then when he's in the car, all he does is kind of lean against the back seat wide-eyed the entire trip. And so we leave him at home if we can. I mean, we only take him if he absolutely has to go. Remember, when you're traveling with your pet, always question what's going to be best for them. If getting there is going to be so horrible, why take them? But it sounds like you might be spending more time in Florida, and once she gets there, she's probably very happy to be able to, be with you in a warmer climate.
There you go. Thanks, Lynn, for calling. Appreciate it. I want to give Marge a chance to join us from Sparta. Marge, hello.
Hello. Yes, I have a really strange question, and my vets can't seem to figure out what it is. I have a dog that's 10 years and 3 months old. She was a guide dog for the blind.
Mm-hmm.
And she was born in Rochester Hills, Michigan, and she is a really wonderful dog. I take her to the vet every 6 months for senior citizen checkups.
Yeah, what's going on with
her blood?
Yeah,
all of her blood work comes back fine.
Uh-huh.
But what is really puzzling us is when I first got her, she had a little white faded spot on the top of her ear.
Uh-huh.
And she's a black lab. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And how usually their muzzles will start turning a little white, mm-hmm, as they get older. Well, she's getting a lot of white spots on her, and then on the back of her neck, all the way across the back of her head,
mm-hmm,
and her ears are turning white.
We'll see graying of hair coats. I mean, we see some labs coming in that just have white hair everywhere. Sometimes it's just around the muzzle. Sometimes it's the whole head. The legs are really a common spot that you'll start seeing some graying. So it may just be genetic, and it's just a normal, you know, maybe a little more than you're used to seeing in aging labs. But I would not look at that as a problem. If her skin is normal and she has, you know, no other changes, then I wouldn't worry about it. There are some weird depigmentation changes like that can happen even with people, where you start losing pigment, and it's possible that something like that is going on, but it's cosmetic and it's nothing to really be concerned about.
So can you use a little hair dye? Or
Grecian formula? I worked with a veterinarian a few years ago that had a black lab and then a black lab mix that had little brown spots over its eyes and brown toes. And she's kind of a crazy veterinarian. And I came in one Saturday and she's got the dog in the bathtub with, and she's using human hair dye. She wants to have two black labs. So she's taking this dog with these spots and dyeing them with just very carefully with some black hair dye. Turned the hair blue. And so this dog walked around until it went through a hair growth cycle with blue feet and blue eyebrows.
Oh.
So, yeah, you can't use human hair dye on dogs. Yeah.
Okay, there you go. Marge, thanks. Catherine and Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. My cat, she eats fabric, and she's done this since she's a kitten. And she literally eats it. You know, she swallows it, and she'll eat like, if I accidentally leave a dish towel out or something, she'll eat like a third of the dish towel.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
So I recently, a few months ago, my vet started her on Prozac, which seems to have helped. She's only eaten fabric once or twice and like only like a nickel size. I was so excited. But she does seem to be more tired. Or just not as active, and though she is like 5 or 6 now, so I wasn't sure if that might be the medication, if I should talk to my vet about trying a different medication, or if older now.
Yeah, it's this is a really interesting compulsive behavior that we see cats doing, and most of the time you're going to see it in the literature referred to as wool sucking, but it really is fabric eating, and because we recognized it years ago, mainly in like the Oriental breeds like Siamese and so on. A common problem is, you know, they'll start chewing on wool. And it's not just sucking on it, it's actually chewing and eating big holes in things. We use psychoactive drugs typically to be able to get this treated. You may want to look at, can you adjust the dose of the drug that she's on? It may be that it's a little too high, and that may make her feel a little less lethargic. So I would play with the dose. Since it sounds like it's really working, I wouldn't want to change to a different class of drug, because other drugs that we would use would be a tricyclic antidepressant. Usually clomipramine is the drug that we would use, and it can cause dry mouth and constipation and other symptoms, and even be a little more sedating. So stick with the Prozac for now, the fluoxetine. It's not labeled for cat use, but I'd look at seeing if you can adjust the dose. Other things that we've done is for these kitties is try to adjust the environment, giving them other things that they can chew on, like kitty greens, planting cat grass and so on. Increasing the fiber in their diet has helped some cats as well. But it's mainly just it's a condition that we see in cats as a way, just like the cat that was over-grooming itself that may be stress-related. Anything that we can do to relieve anxiety. And you'd think, what does a cat have to be anxious about? You know, it's fed, it's in the house, it's safe. But you'd be surprised at the little things that could be bothering her. So,
she doesn't like the cats that walk by the window. That's
sure. And that may be one of the things that's causing this, too, is like she just gets into the chewer's high because it's releasing endorphins. It's a strange pica. I wish I had better answers for you, but it's not that uncommon.
Mm. Okay. Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Catherine, for calling. And just because you mentioned anxiety again, and we're talking about anxiety, and going back to the car anxiety question another caller suggested, as you have at times, the thunder shirt.
Yeah, there's all these other things that you can use. There's the thunder shirt. There's the thunder cape. What I recommend for people to do is before they go out and invest in a thunder shirt, what this was all based on is it's what the thunder shirt is a snug vest type thing that the dog wears, and it supposedly gives them a better sense of body awareness and has some natural calming effects. There was a person back 20 plus years ago named Linda Tellington Jones that started this program called T-Touch, which is a method of you know, calming dogs down through kind of acupressure-y type work. And she has developed, she was using ACE bandages. And if you just, again, Google T-Touch wrap, okay, that'll come up with all kinds of pictures of dogs and horses and so on with all these ACE bandage type configurations that wrap around the dog's chest that made them feel calm and more relaxed. And so instead of having to deal with a bandage all the time, they now are making these jackets commercially. So I always recommend people to use an ACE bandage. Follow one of those pictures that you can find online and see what the dog does. If the dog just shuts down, which a lot of dogs do, if you put clothes on a dog, some dogs just don't want to move. And people feel that that is an indication that the dog isn't anxious anymore. And it may just be that the dog is just shutting down because it doesn't like having this stuff on. Yeah. And so, you know, is the thunder shirt actually relieving anxiety, or is it just shutting the dog down because they don't want to move, they don't want to do anything because they got clothes on? So try it at home before you invest in them. So I whether it's going to work or not, I don't know. They're not that expensive, and so give it a try.
Chad in West Bend, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Well, hello, Larry, and thank you, Dr. Sawchuk, for taking my call. We have a 14-year-old domestic cat, and he's like a voraciously hungry all the time. He's got a lot of energy, and our vet, we're trying to get weight on him. He's only weighing 10.4 pounds. So our vet gave us B12 once a week, and he still continues to pick.
Oh, we're losing your call here.
Unfortunately, Chad, we've lost your...
Yeah. I'm looking at what Judith put up here, that begging for food, voracious, and could it be worms? You know, most cats are able to live with their parasites. If we do see a cat that's heavily parasitized, they usually are vomiting, have diarrhea, you know, and there's going to be other symptoms than being hungry. A 14-year-old cat that has suddenly developed a voracious appetite, I'd be worried about a couple of things. One would be hyperthyroidism, an overactive thyroid gland, and I'd also be concerned about something like diabetes. And I think getting some blood work done, having the cat have a good physical exam done, I'd look into that before I would start saying, hey, this cat needs to be dewormed. But, you know, if the cat, you are seeing things like, you know, tapeworm segments or something, obviously deworm the cat. But I would not be thinking that that would be causing the cat to want to be eating more.
And we did have somebody call in who or send us a note from Facebook that they had to have their one cat put down with diabetes and has another one. And she called him Fat Boy.
Yeah, diabetes is one of those things where when they did a study looking at client satisfaction with dealing with a pet with diabetes, most owners were very unsatisfied with their quality of life because you're looking at usually twice daily insulin injections, frequent veterinary visits, or learning how to do your own glucose monitoring at home by using like ear veins and things, and specialized diets. The best way to prevent it is keep your cat slender. Don't let them get overweight. That's the leading cause of diabetes in cats is obesity.
So let's put them on a diet. No, not on a diet. Just feed them the way they should be fed, I guess.
Yeah. Feed them. If they have to lose weight, then I'd be following your veterinarian's recommendations for a lower calorie diet. Remember, just taking their normal food and feeding less of it could result in nutrient imbalances. And so we want to make sure that they're getting enough of the basic nutrients, just not the stuff that's high calorie, like fat and carbohydrates.
You know, we started talking today about the canine influenza. And again, your site has at the vet school
up to date information on there, not only for clients or pet owners, but also for veterinarians. And I suggest if anybody has any questions that they go to that first.
All right. And if you want a a little summary of it, of what occurred today on the show. I'm pretty sure Judith is working on a little story, and we'll have that up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show later on today. So we'll have that as well. Sandy, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're back on May 12th.
I am.
I'm looking forward to it. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, our guest. She'll be back on May 12th. Tomorrow at 11, we'll hear about the Great Wisconsin Birdathon, which launches tomorrow. And at 11:45, some news from the International Crane Foundation. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.